Is it just more that we're missing? It looks like. That's right. Casey and Toast. Toast. Is this Casey and Maura? Yeah, we got a few minutes. Maura had to go into town. She might not be back anyway. Were there any questions about what we talked about this morning? About this ongoing process of deluded eye-making.
I really asked about feeling being basically, I like this, I don't like that, and I don't care about what's in between.
It's feeling that contributes to that discriminating thinking.
Because I'm still playing with feeling, craving, clinging, and where those distinctions lie.
There's a few different discourses where the Buddha's teaching dependent origination. In fact, some of them have only 9 links. He incorporates feeling to craving, he incorporates craving, clinging, and maintaining as one link, which relates a little closer to the second noble truth. The second noble truth is craving and clinging.
Yeah.
So again, it's just a situation. This, I think it's more useful to separate it out because craving is different than clinging. Craving, and again, it's just a word. Craving is the same as desiring, and it's initially much deeper than just craving for chocolate cake, what I usually use as an example. It's craving for the existence of a self-referential ego self that is the point. It's not craving for chocolate cake. So the desire for continued existence of that which cannot be established is the ultimate problem. And once that is established through feeling, once there's just that initial experience of something, craving then leads to clinging, and clinging leads to that continued establishment, maintaining. So again, it's something that happens almost outside of time. It's not something that we can follow in a linear time frame.
Okay, that's where I'm not quite sure, you know, how to follow that progression.
And that's part of the confusion about this. I was talking to Howard after lunch today. This really describes a circular process rather than a linear process.
Mm-hmm.
And so at any point in the circle, you can find becoming leading to birth. At another point in that circle, you might be back at the beginning of ignorance again. And this is an ongoing circle that we maintain through craving and clinging. And at any other point, it might be that consciousness leading to name and form is what we're experiencing at the moment. But we're caught in this constant, I'm going to talk about that too a little bit deeper. We're caught in this constant feedback loop that maintains itself. Mm-hmm. It's just discursive, deluded thinking. Tracy.
So when the Buddha talks about the cycle of samsara, is this in relationship to that?
Yes. And we continue it. We're continually walking in samsara in a linear time frame, but that circle is maintained. But we're also doing it in a very minute way, moment by moment. We're continuing samsara. And the important point to remember is that at any point, we can recognize this is occurring and get off the circle. We can start heading in a different direction. We can start creating another circle that is winding around. I said earlier that impermanence is the selfing giving rise to the, to dukkha revolves around impermanence. And if you, so now think about impermanence as a point on that circle. If you start developing awakening, then impermanence becomes what selfing leading to liberation is revolving around. So you can say that we're substituting ignorance within that process of impermanence. I hope I'm not making this more complicated than it is. And having that circle now lead to liberation rather than back to dukkha. We're, another way of saying that is we're, that constant circle is maintained by ignorance, and at any point in that circle we can insert wisdom, and it changes where the circle ends then. Does that make more sense? That's the idea. So the Buddha's teaching is not linear, although we experience it that way. It really is a circular teaching. Another way to see that, and it was another one of these aha moments for me, is I was reading a particularly obscure sangha discourse and having difficulty seeing, well, how does this make sense? And then I remembered, well, the Buddha's teaching this not as a standalone teaching. He's not teaching math one day and history the next. Everything he's teaching relates back to the Four Noble Truths. And then the discourse itself made sense. So we can't take any of this out of context and hope that it's meaningful for us, because it won't be. It just doesn't apply. We're taking the teaching out of school now. Does that make sense? Is that helpful? Particularly to you, Tracy, does that, you see it? Yeah, thank you for asking. We're just missing more. I don't know if we should wait for her or not, because she might be a while. More can get into a wandering mode. She's like Vachagoda. She'll come back and she'll ask a question. any questions about where we are? Because I'm going to go into a little bit more detail. I don't want to get too deep into this. Let's see where this goes. So I'm picking up just about where I left off before. It is also ignorance of the Four Noble Truths to hold the belief that an ego personality, slow down, becomes formless at death, but survives physical death as the same personality, either in an eternal formless state or being reborn as the same soul. So everybody understands that. That's the common belief in reincarnation, that this individual being will continue throughout eternity as the same soul, as the same identity, carrying the same baggage from one life to the next, or maybe carrying the same privileges from one life to the next. That was a common belief 2,600 years ago, and it's still very common today. And the Buddha and the teachings on selfing and impermanence say that that can't possibly be true. Everything is in a process of becoming. So, and the best example that I can give of this in a practical way is I am the same John Haspel I was born into. I'm the same John that I was when I was 5 years old, and yet I'm completely different. And the only connection that you can make between a 60-year-old John and one 55 years ago is continuation. But remember, continuation obscures impermanence. Along the way, there's an infinite number of impermanent experiences that happen to end up right here, right now, today, May 20th, 2016. This particular process began September 5th, 1955. And we don't have the capability of seeing all of the changes that took place in each impermanent moment. We can't track it. Again, the scientists are trying to figure out that. And I heard read somewhere recently that they think they found that the what is the particle called that they were looking for? I can't remember. But they think they found the God particle. They think they were able to isolate the Higgs boson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we were talking about that. So there, even scientists are able to take matter, which is what we're made of, and reduce it down to this incredibly small particle that is part of this process of continued impermanence. But again, remember, continuity obscures impermanence, but it doesn't establish anything permanent. Everything is in that process of becoming. Does that make sense? So that holds that when this physical body dies, there's nothing at all that the five clinging aggregates have now fallen apart. There's nothing to sustain this thing called John at all. How could John be reborn now? Doesn't hold up. It doesn't hold up to the Buddha's teaching. It holds up to theory. We can say, well, because I think I have a soul. That famous saying, I think, therefore I am, using that. I mean, that's one of the most misguided repeated quotes of all time. I think, therefore I am. I think, therefore I'm confused about what I am is more accurate. It is. So there's no ongoing process. I'm getting a little bit off on a tangent on that, just that one paragraph. So it's the belief in an eternal formless state or being reborn as the same soul is just as much of a fabrication rooted in ignorance as anything else that develops from this. Becoming, birth, sickness, old age, death, and non-becoming is the environment of dukkha or suffering caused by ignorance. The links of clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense base, name and form, consciousness, and fabrications are all part of the process of I-making arising from ignorance. And we want to make much more out of that. We want to make a cosmic being out of this thing that's arisen out of ignorance. And we want to maintain it as significantly and as long as we possibly can, when all it can possibly give us is continued suffering. The Buddha's teachings on anatta. What you think of yourself is not a self. Let it go. Let go of the views. You're not letting go of anything substantial. It'll be a little bit more clear in just a moment. This process is maintained by continued ignorance, furthering our own karma. The Buddha then describes how clinging to the notion of self maintains this feedback loop of the sixth sense base, establishing a self, and maintaining the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. Am I slowing down my reading at all? I can't tell.
You are.
Am I? Okay.
This morning you were...
Well, I don't often drink coffee either, but I had a cup this morning. Actually, I had some for lunch too. And what is clinging, Buddha's words, and what is clinging and maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Clinging to sensory stimulus. Something makes me feel good, or something makes me feel bad. I'm still clinging. I'm clinging to aversion now. Clinging to sensory stimulus. Clinging to views, meaning condition. Clinging to my own conditioned thinking. I think, therefore I am. I've decided what my life experience is going to be, and I'm holding on to it because that's my establishment. That's clinging to views. My dad was a Republican. Donald Trump was getting my vote. And not implying that he shouldn't. I'm just using that as an example. Conditioned thinking. Clinging to a view. My dad liked the Yankees. The Mets are an awful team. I don't care how good they are this year. Clinging to view. Most of these are as insignificant as that too. But in totality, they drive our existence and they lead to dukkha. Who cares if it's Mets or Yankees or the Cleveland Indians? Doesn't matter. It's baseball. The Buddha is cautioning against developing or maintaining practices that are given validity simply from the positive feeling developed or the positive or commonly accepted views reinforced. Engaging in rituals or practices that continue a doctrine of self in any realm, physical or otherwise, are also to be abandoned. The Buddha talked about using rituals and practices to establish a religion around and talked against it, to beware of it and let it go, because we're establishing a self in those rituals and practices. I'm not developing, we make the ritual and practices more important than engaging in the Eightfold Path. And a lot of that has happened. That's very common in modern Buddhism. The chanting, the bowing, the environment that you create has become more important than actually engaging in the Eightfold Path, something the Buddha talked very specifically about. Abandon those rituals and practices, because those are the trappings that we use to establish a self while fooling ourselves that we're actually doing something useful. Combining the words useful and worthwhile to use while. Engaging in rituals or practices that continue a doctrine of self in any realm, physical or otherwise, are also to be abandoned. The Buddha here has taken a methodical route from the ultimate unfolding of ignorance, suffering arising from birth, back to the second noble truth. He's reversed the process and showed us how to do it. Right? Profound understanding of any one of these links begins to unravel the entire causative chain. So if you can see that process of feeling leading to craving and understand and penetrate it at its root, You can abandon that process. And if you abandon any one of these processes, like any chain, the whole chain falls apart. There's nothing there left to hold it together. So, and the reason why that's an important teaching is this can seem overwhelming. How come I'm ever going to be able to figure all this out? Well, you don't have to. You just have to understand craving and clinging, the second noble truth.
I was thinking of Sosan's saying of the great way is easy for those who have no preferences.
Yeah. And this is, so think of this more as a circle that we were talking about, and don't get fixated on any one point. It's just describing a process in minute detail of how we end up with suffering. But the Buddha didn't start, remember, the Buddha didn't teach direct dependent origination until much later in his teaching. To put it, dependent origination in context, he taught the Four Noble Truths. He said that dukkha occurs. And dukkha occurs because of craving and clinging. He's pointing to that ninth factor of the 12 links. If you can remain well focused and well intentioned on recognizing and abandoning craving and clinging, the whole chain falls apart. You don't have to get too much into feeling beyond the four foundations of mindfulness or the rest of it. You don't have to get caught up in is this my sixth sense base kicking in here? Recognize that something's coming through contact. And I'll get into a little bit more about how that occurs and gets tied into this in just a moment. What's most important to remember about this whole process is that it is from ignorance that sets in place this whole 12-link causative chain. And if you remember that, then what am I ignorant of? I need to develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths through the Eightfold Path. Right? Is that clear? So again, I'm putting a lot of emphasis on dependent origination, so hopefully you won't overemphasize it and just understand that this describes the process that ends up in dukkha. That's the only thing that's really valuable about this. So profound understanding of any one of these links begins to unravel the entire causative chain. For example, a profound understanding that phenomena, contact, and senses develops feelings, and that feeling develops craving for more self-affirming contact with worldly phenomena. And this brings this, once this is understood, it brings this passion for constant sensory stimulation. What that means is we get fed up with chasing constant sensory stimulation. We realize that it's leading us down this confused, deluded path. I don't want to do it anymore. Does that make sense? We'll stop basing our lives on what makes us feel good or avoiding what might bring us displeasure, and we'll put our attention on the path that gets us out of it. Another way of saying that is dukkha, the preoccupation with dukkha is a distraction that maintains craving and clinging. And self-referential ego self, that which the Buddha said is anatta, requires, it's dependent on this process to continue. It requires the constant distraction of dealing with dukkha to maintain itself. Right? So when we can start undoing this, the reason why concentration is so important, a useful meditation practice, developing concentration, is because it starts diminishing that distraction of dukkha, the preoccupation with it. We start creating a little bit of space between one craving thought and the next clinging thought. And in that space, we start beginning to develop the ability to unravel this. Does that make sense? In theory, anyway. This develops the understanding that contact via sensory stimulus is the direct result of the belief in an ego self, or name and form, and not an inevitable life experience. This seems like this just happens to us. And if we take that view, that there's nothing we can do to interrupt this, then there is nothing to do. But if you recognize that every part of this has some selfing involved, then we can interrupt the process. We could interrupt the becoming and point it in a different direction, become something else, become an awakened human being. Seeing this process clearly depersonalizes the life experience. From this understanding, life experience no longer will describe and maintain the ego personality. The refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path maintains clear and present right view of life as life occurs, with no reaction caused by personalization. The self is out of this now. The implications of this realization can be unsettling at first if one is engaging the Dhamma to fix a flawed self, which is what most of us come to, whether we see it that way or not. We think there's something wrong with us, and this is the way to figure out what's wrong. And that can lead to a lot of continued deluded thinking until we realize that there is a flawed self to fix, but what we're really fixing is just a view. It's not something substantial. It's something that is in a constant state of flux, including that notion of a broken self. We're not chasing after that. Many people, when they first start taking to the Dhamma wholeheartedly, come up against this. Well, if I'm letting go of all views, what's going to become of me? And it becomes very fearful to a lot of people. A lot of fear comes up at that point. There's this feeling of annihilation. You talked about that a couple weeks ago in a slightly different way at class. And the concern about, well, isn't this so negative? Aren't we just reinforcing another negative belief about self? Everything is suffering and I'm the cause of it. But the Buddha didn't stop there. Remember, he gave us an eightfold path to recognize this process clearly. He gave us a path out of this way of thinking. So we're not fixing anything that's substantial. What we're so concerned about is as fleeting as the foam on an ocean. The Buddha often used that term to refer to a self. It's like foam on an ocean. There's nothing substantial here. If you can see that clearly, it's easy to let go of. Initially, we're stuck in that clinging view of self. This is all I am. And that clinging is part of conditioned thinking. It's hard to unravel that at first. But when you have the background of where this comes, I think it makes it a little bit easier anyway. I hope it does. Remember that what is abandoned when the process of I-making is interrupted is only a fabricated ego personality that is stuck in confusion and unsatisfactory experiences. That's all it can ever have, ultimately. Once understood, the release from the burden of an ego personality brings the continual experience of lasting peace and happiness. We let it go, just as the Buddha let it go. It is also important to remember that the teachings on dependent origination are given to develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Dependent origination explains the process of how all personal phenomena arises so that understanding of the distraction of dukkha can be realized. Understanding dependent origination supports developing right view while showing that holding wrong or ignorant view is the cause of all confusion and suffering. Does everybody see that? Does everybody see the link between ignorance now and resulting, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths results in the experience of dukkha? Yeah, everybody sees it? Yeah, I mean, we all haven't had the experience of it yet, or we wouldn't be listening to me anymore, but that's the point. You know, you can leave out those other, ignorance is the first chain. You can leave out the other 11 chains and just understand that it's from ignorance of the Four Noble Truths that sets this process in motion. The Third Noble Truth says that the process can end through the Eightfold Path. The emergence of anatta and ego personality within an environment of anicca, that's the bottom three, selfing, impermanence leading to suffering. It is also important to remember that the teachings on dependent origination are given to develop, the emergence of anatta and ego personality within an environment of anicca, resulting in the unsatisfactoriness and confusion of dukkha, is not a personal, arbitrary, or chaotic development from which there is no cessation. It often seems like that. It seems like we don't have any control over this, but we have complete control over it. To some, that's a scary enough thought, that it's up to me now. It's not up to grace. It's not up to merit. It's not up to anything else but our own efforts. The Buddha, when he referred to himself as the Tathagata, was saying that I am a rightly self-awakened one, meaning he did it himself. And then he taught us how we can become rightly self-awakened, meaning we got to do it ourselves. There's a pretty heavy responsibility until you realize that all we got to do is engage in this path. Tracy.
So is dependent origination completely contained within the Second Noble Truth?
In the first two truths.
In the first two truths.
In the first two truths. But yes, it's very perceptive to say that because you can rightly say that if you can understand and abandon craving and clinging, you have undone dependent origination. And when the Buddha describes, and I think I might get to it today or tonight, when the Buddha describes awakening as it relates to the Four Noble Truths, He says it in very simple and direct terms. Dukkha has been understood, but at a profound level. We've understood the results of that 12 causative links. And then he describes awakening as it relates to the second noble truth, as craving and clinging has been abandoned. That's an awakened human being. You've undone the 12 causative links through your own efforts. Great question. There's just one other part of this, the Paticca Samuppada, Abhanga Sutta, that I wanted to read. Describing that, and Buddha's words, and what is craving? There are six classes of craving. And just notice how this applies to us individually, how we do this. He's talking about human beings now, nothing esoteric or mystical. There are six classes of craving, craving for forms. So initial craving is craving for a physical form. We decide this is us, we want more of maintaining this. But it's also craving for chocolate cake, the next relationship, the brand new car, the bigger house. It might be just craving for a little bit of relief from the stress of life, but we do it in strange ways.
Craving for sensations.
Craving for sounds. We hear a pleasant sound. Again, this is very human things. Some people decide that they love opera, but they can't stand hip-hop. I agree with them. But some people couldn't stand to listen to one stanza, but they can listen to hip-hop continually. Craving for sounds, that's all it is. In a very practical way. It might be someone's voice. It could be the sound of a bird. And when we don't hear that bird one morning, it starts our day off in the wrong direction. This is craving for sounds, craving for that constant input of something we created an identity about. I really love the sound of robins in the morning. It's creating an identity because someday that robin's not going to be here and you started your day off on a disappointing note. That seems insignificant. But when you realize that you've created your whole life out of likes and dislikes, then your whole life leads to dukkha, to a disappointing experience. But if you don't have any self-identity, self-referential self in relation to the robin or the sound of someone's voice, then life is just a series of what's becoming. It doesn't have to be anyway, because there's no self involved. Where was I? Craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for smells, craving for taste, craving for physical sensations, and craving for ideas. But these are self-referential ideas. We crave for ideas that continue to establish a self, and we do that all the time. We do it with religions, including Buddhist religions, but not just Buddhist religions. We do it with systems that we put in place that continue to establish a self, whether they're religious or not. And I don't want to, I don't know why I said that, because I don't want to go too deep into that. But, so the Buddha continues describing this process. What is feeling? Feeling has six classes as well, relating to the sixth sense base. Feeling arising from eye contact. Something looks beautiful, it makes us feel good. A beautiful sunset. More, I had to run out to see the sunset last night. And again, I understand, I'm not putting her down. I understand, it's beautiful. Let's see it. I've told the story about the green flash a few times in class. I had this experience in Hawaii one time of seeing this sunset described by the green flash. The sunset sets rather quickly in Hawaii because it's closer to the equator. And occasionally when the sun sets below the equator, at that point where it dips below the equator, you'll see this green flash across the horizon. It's incredible to see. And I was told about it, and I decided that I'm going to see it. And so I spent some time sitting there looking at these beautiful sunsets. And finally one day, there it was, the green flash. And it just blew me away. I got up, and I don't dance. I never did. Even when I had good legs, I didn't dance. I jumped up off the beach, and I started dancing around and waving my arms. It was one of the most incredible experiences I ever had. The next day, I sat down on that beach, and I want to see that green flash again. And I'm sitting there, thinking, the sun's going down. It's beautiful. And the sun goes down, and as soon as the sun goes down, if you ever watch the Hawaiian sunset, even if it's a lousy sunset, it's incredible because the colors are just amazing. And the sun's going down, and I'm waiting for the green flash, and the sun dips down, there's no green flash. I was sitting in the most beautiful place in the world. I just saw the second most beautiful sunset that I've ever seen, and it was a disappointment. Because I needed to see the green flash again. Hawaiians spend their whole lives and never see it. I was lucky enough. About 2 weeks later, I saw it again. And the next day, it brought out more craving, and I needed to see it the third time. I've never seen it again, but I've lost the need to see it again. So that's craving arising from eye contact. That's what the Buddha, in very practical terms. We see something, we become enamored with it, we create an identity for it, and we need more of it, whatever it is. Even if it starts to becoming destructive in our lives. We do that with addiction and compulsive behaviors all the time. Something makes us feel good. Even if it starts then making us feel bad, we've created an identity, we're clinging to it, and we keep chasing it around. Feeling arising from eye contact, feeling arising from ear contact, from nose contact, from taste contact, from body contact, from intellect contact. This is called feeling. Things coming through, this is called feeling. It comes through our senses, we create a feeling about it, tied into what I'll get to next. And so what is contact? Contact is phenomena, the outside world, contacting the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the intellect. This is contact with the sixth sense base, our human feelings, our human sense organs, including that consciousness with a small c that's now rooted in ignorance and discriminating this contact through that rooted ignorance. All that it can determine now is based on ignorance. The Buddha gets into now describing nama-rupa, or name and form. And what is name and form? Form, feeling, perceptions, intention, attention. In other words, what we're putting our mindfulness on. This is a teaching on not all mindfulness is good mindfulness. It can create delusion in our lives. And what is name and form? Feeling, perception, intention, attention, and contact. Discriminating consciousness is name. We start deciding things, this is what I am. Discriminating consciousness. And now the elements that make up a physical body and a physical universe. The elements of water, fire, earth, and wind. That which makes up physical forms is called form. It's all form. Name and, these are my words, name and form is a discriminating consciousness bound to, excuse me, or clinging to physical form. And now the Buddha wants to describe the thought process rooted in ignorance. And what is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness relating to the six senses. There is eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and intellect consciousness. The Buddha is taking our normal human physical senses and saying in a little bit of a cute way, be careful about these. Because it's that contact through our senses that we use to assume and create, continually create a self that's also leading to delusion because it's rooted in ignorance. Another simple way of saying it, the Buddha never did, so maybe I shouldn't, but another simple way of saying it is you can't believe everything you see. You can't believe everything you hear. Why? Because your view at the moment is rooted in ignorance. You don't have the proper view to see it. When you develop right view, which happens pretty quickly, then you can trust what you see, and you can trust what you feel, and you can trust what you hear. You can start trusting your interactions with other people because it's framed by the Eightfold Path. That's how the value of right speech, right action, and right livelihood as we're developing understanding is if we are using that as a framework for our lives, we don't have to second-guess ourselves anymore. We're good to go. It's just a very simple and direct way of knowing that we can trust now what we see and what we hear and how we act and how we respond.
He does talk a lot about the bhikkhu with his senses well guarded.
Exactly. That's the Buddha talking about this. Well guarded means that you know how to interpret phenomena. It comes through our senses. If we have a mind that's settled in a refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, we're seeing things through right view now, and we can trust what we see. The Buddha was so perceptive because he could see someone standing in front of him, and he didn't have a distorted view. This is why the Buddha was often given superpowers, because he could look at someone and know who they were and what they were about. But it wasn't anything supernatural about it. He was just not seeing things through a clouded view. He was seeing things clearly. Moro, you were going to say something?
Wow. was going to take issue with the fact that once you have right view, you're able to, and you said it develops quite quickly, and you're able to see things clearly, and you no longer doubt yourself. That hasn't been my experience. I guess I don't have right view.
You mean more deep?
Well,
this idea of being short.
Let me qualify it for you.
Once you start to, you know, this thing happens so quickly, and then fabrications, are on there. So maybe one can say, well, I know this might be a fabrication.
So let me qualify it. I'm not referring to a fully awakened human being,
right.
But the establishment of right view happens very quickly. I would say that everyone in this room has established right view, meaning that initial right view that's inclining your mind towards awakening. That's the most significant point of any of this process, because if you don't have that initial right view, you can't get to super mundane or fully awakened right view. And that does happen very quickly.
Right. That wasn't my. And then you had said, then you no longer doubt what you see and hear. And I would say, for my own self, that my perceptions are still quite clouded and delusional at times.
At times,
so maybe you can clarify that.
Well, once we start to integrate the Eightfold Path, and I don't think this takes a lot of time. I think it's different for everybody. But once we understand the Eightfold Path in particular as far as behavior, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, and we incorporate those very simple methods of behavior, we can trust what we're doing in life.
Trust what we're doing or what we're seeing?
Well, the same thing. Because we're seeing it within that mindful framework. But again, it has to be developed. And with some people, this doesn't mean, well, it should have happened for you a long time ago. It just means that everybody's different. But I bet you everyone in this room, including you more, would say that you see life a little bit more clearly when you see it through the framework of the Eightfold Path. Mm-hmm. No, you wouldn't say that?
But it does require constant attention and
mindfulness.
Mindfulness, vigilance.
Yep. That's the refinement.
I can decide that somebody's a jerk in a second, and I know that and you and I have had multiple discussions on this, being able to see someone's actions and see if those actions are skillful or not doesn't mean they're a jerk, all this stuff. It means that they're engaging in harmful, deluded behavior. But I don't know that I just think that there's a lot still. One can see it within the framework of the Eightfold Path, but that does seem like a very strong statement that we no longer can, like, now we know what we can no longer doubt what we see.
Maybe it is too strong of a statement in a general way, but but then again, it isn't. Part of the problem is, especially in modern Buddhism, is that we have, and I'm not speaking to anybody, certainly not you directly, but we have many different concepts about what this means. And that makes it much more difficult to develop right view. Remember, the Buddha, this is what the Buddha taught. He didn't teach a lot of these other concepts that we're so enamored with today. He taught a very simple and direct path. And when that path can be accessed and enabled directly, without a lot of other conditioning around it, progress can be very quick, but not necessarily. So I use Kandana as an example of someone who took to the Dhamma the first time he heard it and awakened. And then I also use the example of Ananda, who took many, many years to finally develop awakening. But even that, even if it's 45 years to awaken, to me that's pretty quick the way it's mostly portrayed today, that it takes eons and eons, limitless eons, to develop awakening. It doesn't. The point about that is that this is something we can develop in this lifetime, in our lifetime.
I thought you meant a couple of weeks, so it sounded like you should just never doubt your perception.
And some people it is a couple of weeks. Some people it's one listening. Again, the point, and maybe I am overemphasizing that, but this is for human beings to awaken in this lifetime. It's not something we need to put off. But if we have a lot of conditions about. Some people come to the Dhamma with no conditions at all. They've never been involved in any religion at all. They've never been involved, especially in a Buddhist religion. And from the people that I've taught, they have a much easier time developing right view rather quickly. Those of us like me that went through a lot of different schools and different teachings and things that were Buddhist and some that were not and created an identity have a much more difficult time getting initial right view and being able to see things clearly, because we still have that, you know, I hung on to emptiness for many, many years, trying to fit that view into, and I was studying the Buddha's direct teachings. And I just couldn't reconcile that. But I still had it. It was clouding my understanding of what the Buddha was teaching. When I finally realized that and let go of all of those views that I thought that Buddhism should be, then the simple path became clear to me. And so that's really what I'm referring to. For many of us, it can be happen very quickly. Some of us, it takes a little bit longer, especially those of us that have other views related to this that are tied into it.
I wasn't even really talking about views. I was talking on day-to-day just interactions. You know, it's my understanding that still. Okay, so maybe you're saying, okay, well, you can understand that you're still somewhat confused.
Does it depend on how concentrated your mind is? Because if you have you might have an insight into, or you have this insight into what right view is, you have an insight into watching your clinging and craving, but life is occurring all the time, and you're not necessarily in control of what's the phenomenon that's occurring around you. So depending on how your day is going, or if you're sick, like you get thrown off, and then maybe right view is you're not as clear about it. This is for someone just beginning to study or beginning to.
Yeah,
you. Is that what you're? I'm just trying to understand what you're talking about.
Do you want to respond?
I don't know. I guess it's probably maybe perhaps somewhat semantics. Yes, Laura, I would say that day to day things change, and sometimes the momentum of one's previous choices can cloud your perception of what's happening at any given time. But it depends on what you had said about it requires, constant diligent mindfulness and effort and dedication. I was responding to the fact that you said it develops very quickly, and now you're no longer unsure of what you can. You can be absolutely sure on what you see, and I think there's still all this past conditioning. So one can understand there's still conditioning clouding my thinking somewhat, but I can see it within the context of the Eightfold Path.
But isn't that also right view?
Well, that's what I'm saying. So that might be
to me
right
that
view.
It is.
See it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
you
so
see,
you have a chance to pause
exactly
before you actually act out anything.
Yeah.
That's right view.
That is. It doesn't mean that there's more right view to develop. That's the point of right view. That's why right view is the first factor of the Eightfold Path. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that later today or tomorrow, what the Buddha said is right view. I'll say it right now. Right view is understanding suffering. So initially we understand, okay, I need to develop an understanding of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. Ultimately, what right view is a complete understanding of the Four Noble Truths. We start and end at the same point, and that's the direction that we develop. That happens, that part of it happens very quickly. For some of us, we get to the end of the path in a matter of moments, like Kandana, and some of us, the path takes 45 years, like Ananda. Most of us are somewhere in the middle. The important point of that is that this is an achievable goal. It's not something that should be looked at as, I can't do it, or I've been told that it takes endless eons. The Buddha says that it happens now, and it does happen somewhat quickly for most people. Laura, what you were talking about, you're right. The reason why there's a meditation practice involved in this at all, that it's an eightfold path and not a sevenfold path, is that we need a way to develop concentration because we're so distracted by dukkha. That's the sole purpose of the Buddha teaching meditation, to develop that concentration to support the refined mindfulness so that we can integrate the Eightfold Path. So, and the reason why I say that is many people use meditation for all kinds of things. I did too, for having certain experiences, for experiencing emptiness, for traveling around the cosmos. You know, for years I was a student of Robert Monroe in the Monroe Institute, out of body travel. Now everybody gets up and walks away and goes to that idiot. We need that concentration. The Buddha started with that. You need to develop a meditation practice, but it was also a very simple meditation practice. He didn't attach a lot of things to it. He says, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut. Focus on your breath. And then incorporate the other seven factors. Let me finish what he's talked about here. And what is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness related to the senses: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and intellect consciousness. So each one of these, the sixth sense base, has its own type of interpretive consciousness. And now we're talking about fabrications. And what are fabrications? So we see how the Buddha's taking us all the way back to the beginning. And what are fabrications? There are three fabrications: bodily fabrications. We attach a fabrication to this form. Verbal fabrications and mental fabrications. We attach these fabrications through the way that we talk to each other, and we hold these fabrications in mind. And you can, a lot of times you can see where a person is coming from when you hear what they have to say, don't you? Because they're revealing their fabrications through their speech. Yeah, and we reinforce it the same way. That's why right speech is so powerful in developing understanding of craving and clinging. Our fabrications are coming out of our mouth all the time. Verbal fabrications. All three fabrications are caused by a wrong view of self. Fabrications result in a personality bound to physical form that is perceived as I or me. So now the Buddha describes ignorance. And what is ignorance? He's taking us all the way back to the beginning. And what is ignorance? Ignorance is not knowing stress or not knowing dukkha. That's his major declarative statement. Ignorance is not knowing the First Noble Truth. Not knowing the cessation of dukkha, not knowing the cessation of stress, that's also ignorance. You haven't had the experience yet. The Third Noble Truth says that it's possible, and when he describes awakening as it relates to the Third Noble Truth, he says that the cessation of stress has been experienced. So ignorance is not having that experience. Not knowing the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress is ignorance. So it's all related to the First Noble Truth, to the Four Noble Truths. So how do we end ignorance that sets this whole causative chain into motion, ending in suffering? We develop understanding of the Four Noble Truths through the path that he gave us, the Eightfold Path. So the whole point of all these words today is to point to the understanding that the Buddha awakened from to this idea that it's ignorance of these four sustainable noble truths, truth throughout time. They're just as true today as they were 2,600 years ago. They still affect humanity, meaning each and every one of us, in exactly the same way. And so the way out of it, according to the Buddha, is to engage in the Eightfold Path. So I hope I made the point that the Eightfold Path is kind of important. Just a little bit more, and we'll let go of this for today. The Buddha relates dependent origination back to his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths and teaches that from ignorance of the Four Noble Truths comes all confusion and suffering. Gaining understanding of the Four Noble Truths is gaining wisdom. Wisdom brings an end to ignorance and an end to the distraction, confusion, and suffering caused by ignorance. Wisdom brings an end to the delusion of an independently arisen self, meaning I made this and I'm going to hold on to it. When all ignorance is abandoned, awakening arises. So now the Buddha is describing what that means. Now from the remainderless fading and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of fabrication. We've developed profound understanding of the Four Noble Truths. All the fabrications fall aside. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. There's nothing for deluded thinking to be born of. The 12-link chain is falling apart right in front of our eyes. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. There's nothing, there's no ignorant thinking left to establish an ignorant person within a physical form. You're not giving a name to it anymore. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense base. So some people will take that last as annihilation. Well, does that mean that the sixth sense base is gone? No, it's no longer used to perpetuate ignorance, that's all. The sixth sense base has come to cessation as it relates to ignorance. And now it's simply used as a function of the ego being a function of the mind. We start interpreting things clearly. We're seeing clearly. We have attained right view. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. Now remember, it's not all feeling. The Buddha suffered horribly at the end of his life. He was still feeling. But his feeling wasn't rooted in ignorance. And he didn't die hating the person that gave him that rotten pork. He died with a peaceful heart and a peaceful mind. That's the best description I can give of how that works. He wasn't creating any more fabrications. He understood it was just a process of becoming. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. There's nothing left to fuel craving for. The most important craving is craving for the continued existence of an ego personality. We no longer need to establish it because we've ended ignorance. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. Since we're no longer craving, there's nothing left to cling to or to maintain. The Buddha is describing how this whole chain of the causative chain falls apart. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. So again, that's something that people refer to as annihilation. Remember, what the Buddha is talking about is continued becoming of a person that is prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. When you start undoing this, when you gain wisdom where there was once ignorance, you stop that process of becoming more ignorant. And you gain the process of becoming wise like a Buddha. And that points to impermanence. So, from the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. I just talked about that. We're no longer giving birth to another ignorant moment. That's the important thing to remember about giving birth. I should have told that to my mother, but why did I say that? The reason why I said it, about 2 days before I got married, I was been married once and divorced once, and I guess my mother wasn't too excited about getting me married, but my future ex-wife asked my mother one day, what was John like as a child? And my mother, I still remember this. My mother got this, she was just the gentlest woman you ever heard, never said a bad word about anybody. She got this faraway look in her eyes. And, John was a difficult child. Joanne still married me, but she found out that still went on a little bit. So. let me go back. What?
So we'll put it on your gravestone.
It was a difficult child. I lost my place for just a moment. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of all the things that we don't want to experience. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of sickness, aging, death, sorrow, pain, distress, despair, and confusion. Wisdom brings a cessation to the entire mass of stress of suffering. So again, that's something else that people point to. Well, the Buddha is saying that there's no longer life because if we have a human life, we still are subject to sickness, aging, and death, just as the Buddha was, just as we all are once we have reached that stage of arahantship. What's the difference? We no longer resist or react to sickness, aging, and death, being separated from that which we love, being associated with that which we loathe. We maintain that mind of equanimity because there's no self-referential ego self involved in that process anymore. We've brought wisdom to where there was once ignorance. And since there is now wisdom in our life, since we understand this process, none of these other chain of events can come into existence. Meaning that whole five mass of five clinging aggregates that is suffering. Did I make that clear? Yeah? So the Eightfold Path develops a path that is a path that develops heightened wisdom, heightened virtue, and heightened concentration. All three qualities of mind are requisite conditions to end ignorance. Developing these three qualities creates the condition for the cessation of ignorance. Dependent origination describes the ongoing process rooted in ignorance that fabricates the ego personality, and how the ego personality, how anatta, is maintained by craving and clinging. This is perhaps the most significant difference between the Buddha's teachings and religious and philosophical systems, including most later developed Buddhist schools. A modern example of this is the misunderstanding and misapplication of dependent origination used to develop a doctrine of interdependence, interconnectedness, and interbeing between individual and insubstantial ego personalities. So, another important point that I'd like to make, does anybody see how dependent origination, as taught by the Buddha, can lead to a doctrine of interdependence? And that's not to say that there isn't. Forget that for a moment. There's nothing here that teaches that. And when we start creating a notion of interdependence, meaning that we're all interdependent on all the infinite aspects of the universe, there's no relevance to what the Buddha taught here, is there?
It just describes this.
Describes something different.
In each person.
And if the Buddha said, when he's describing dukkha, and the five clinging aggregates are dukkha, the notion of interdependence or interconnectedness is interconnecting five clinging aggregates. It's finding a way to continue that establishment. It's finding a way to dismiss dependent origination and create a new doctrine called interdependent origination that completely clouds the most important teaching the Buddha ever gave. From ignorance through 12 causative links, suffering arises. These aren't interdependent. The link, you can't say that ignorance and fabrications are interdependent, because that would say that from fabrications ignorance comes. That would mean that's interdependent. And that, if that was the case, if that was interdependent, or if birth was interdependent with ignorance, there'd be no way out. Because we'd be constantly stuck in this interdependent clinging establishment, which is what interdependence creates.
So,
that's why it's such a damaging doctrine.
I might not say this right, but like, because I haven't looked at it at the level of detail that you have, but like in my, just like easy way that I would see, say like Thich Nhat Hanh saying that we inter are, and I've heard in the Zen traditions things like we only exist in relationship, because, and I always took that to mean, I'm not saying that I'm totally in agreement with this, so I'm not defending this point of view. And it's kind of this thing of perhaps it came from this a misunderstanding of no self again.
It does.
Anatta.
But
meaning, I'm just bear with me. So I'm not defending that point of view. And I'm not saying that it comes from dependent and in origination.
Oh, in fact, you mentioned his name, so I'll use it. That's what Thich Nhat Hanh says implies interbeing. It's a misunderstanding of this. So that, again, that's why I'm bringing it up. And even though you can understand where the confusion comes from, that doesn't make it an acceptable doctrine.
I didn't say it made it an acceptable doctrine. I didn't say that at all. That wasn't.
I'm sorry. I didn't give you a chance. I didn't give you a chance to finish your thought.
I'd rather discuss it elsewhere. I don't want to create any further confusion. Because it would be too long of a discussion, because the whole idea of one only arises in relationship, that is implying that the ego personality only arises, or we only are in this interaction. And that's not true.
Well, I've heard that saying too, that we only exist in interrelationship with other. In other words, I can only exist if you exist.
Or in relationship to this bowl, this floor. This
again, that's part of interdependence. And the reason, it sounds nice, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. but it obviates dependent origination. That's not how we exist. We have, remember, the Buddha wasn't trying to describe this. Please let me finish now more. The Buddha wasn't trying to describe a cosmic existence. He didn't care about that. Even if it can be proven that somehow we only exist in interrelationship with other people or other beings or bowls, that doesn't lead to cessation. What he was concerned about is, where does suffering arise and how can we bring it to cessation? And the idea, even if it's a truthful idea of interdependence, doesn't lead to cessation. It's just a completely different teaching. So I'm not calling anybody out, and I'm certainly not calling Thich Nhat Hanh out. It's interesting how that came up, though. From his point of view, interbeing makes complete sense. From the Buddha's point of view, dependent origination makes complete sense. It's just two different teachings. And they aren't interchangeable. That's the only point that I want to make. And they're often presented that way. And again, the Thich Nhat Hanh's description of dependent origination is interdependence or interconnectedness or interbeing. And it just does not fit together.
And the Buddha would dismiss that as a thicket of views.
Yeah.
He would.
As I said, I shouldn't have brought it up because I'm not trying to say that that's correct. Because it's at all. But it seemed that the way that you were describing it was not what the way that I had just heard it said. In that, you know, he goes on in this whole idea that In the match, the flame is contained.
Yeah, I really don't want to go there. I don't mean to cut you off, but I don't want to hear. I really don't. That what you're describing is a thicket of views. I don't want to introduce it into this room. It really is just that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, but that's where it leads to. It leads to a thicket of views. It's very confusing. So let me get into it just a little bit more about this interdependence. All human beings are connected through the common problem of delusion and suffering. This does not imply or establish a cosmic oneness. It's simply observing what's occurring. We all understand each other's suffering because we understand our own. A common experience does not establish a cosmic oneness. The common result of individual ignorance does not establish a cosmic interdependence, interconnectedness, or interbeing. It just establishes that we're all suffering because of ignorance. Dukkha, no matter how pervasive, no matter how common, is always rooted in ignorance. So why create a doctrine based on ignorance? All human beings are connected through the common problem. I just read that. The Buddha recognized this upon his awakening. He did not teach that we should embrace our suffering, which is often used. He taught to recognize the cause, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, and taught a path to develop wisdom grounded in virtue and refined by profound concentration that ends individual suffering. The Buddha wasn't concerned about ending cosmic suffering or all suffering, because he knew that there was no such thing. He knew that there was only individual suffering. And it's through ending individual suffering that we can end suffering for all beings. Whether that's going to happen, that's up to people to engage in the Eightfold Path. I often say at classes, the most loving, compassionate thing that I can do for all humanity is to take to the Eightfold Path and awaken. Because that's the only effect that I can have on world peace and world harmony. It's what's going on within me. And hopefully, by example, lead others down that.
Can I ask a question? But that's not saying that worldly phenomenon doesn't, you know, like what's happening somewhere else doesn't have an effect on what's happening on us here. That's not what you're saying.
Right? No, it certainly does. And probably in a more profound way, because we hear more about it.
Right.
I mean, 20 years ago, we wouldn't have heard of another plane crash the other day, you know? But that doesn't imply that we're connected to the plane or the people.
Right.
It just means we're human beings and we recognize suffering. It's a horrible thing that 66 people died the other day.
Right.
But that does not teach interbeing or interconnectedness or anything. It just means that it happened.
And that doesn't have to have an effect on your mind.
It doesn't have to have a lasting effect.
Right.
It doesn't have to have a reaction causing further confusion. What it can have is a real feeling of compassion for people that suffered. The Dhamma doesn't take away feeling. It doesn't take away common sense. It doesn't take away our humanity. It's a middle way between extreme views that would have us need to establish ourselves as cosmic beings just so I can feel empathy for Matt. I don't need to. I can feel empathy for Matt because I understand myself. I don't have to say, well, Matt's me, and that's why I hurt when Matt hurts. I hurt because I understand his suffering. That's an important teaching. It's confusing, and it leads to all, and I won't get into this too far, but one of the things that I see clearly is this whole idea of this mishmash of one being leads to all the tension and suffering that causes people to act out towards each other. It's the need to reconcile all religions, I think, today, to make all religions are all one religion, they all have the same point, the same God, the same everything, that leads to people having taking extreme views and saying, no, my Muslim is different than your Catholicism, and if you keep saying it, I'm going to blow you up. And I'm not justifying that reaction, but that's what happens from this misapplication of this unity consciousness. It's just not based in reality, and it leads to all kinds of conflict. We understand suffering. We're connected to each other through suffering. That's enough. And when Matt suffers, I suffer because I understand it. When a plane goes down, I understand it. When a tsunami hits, I understand the suffering. But I also understand that there's not much I can do about it except maintain my own equanimity, maintain my own integrity in relation to the Eightfold Path. It also prevents me from, in a good way, from taking up causes where all that I'm doing is substituting the cause for my Buddhist practice, for developing the Eightfold Path, which happens very commonly today. Often the emphasis of engaged Buddhism is overemphasized, overtaking the Eightfold Path and awakening. And again, I'm getting into a little bit of a political speech that I shouldn't be doing in this setting, but that's really what occurs. It's only the danger that happens when we substitute something for the Eightfold Path and call it the Dhamma.
So I'm still confused. I'm sorry. For you to say that when Matt suffers, you suffer. Do you suffer? Or do you have...
Well, now you're playing with words.
Feeling.
It's just playing with words. I understand his suffering and I can feel it. I can feel it. I know what it feels like. So I can have that experience.
So, I mean, this is because we're talking about suffering and the end of suffering. That's all. That's where I'm confused to use it.
Okay, so I'll explain it to you. The suffering that we cause is sticking a second arrow in. It's having a reaction. Something happens to Matt. He's suffering. I recognize his suffering and I feel it. I don't go to the next step saying, that should be different. That should never occur. Or I shouldn't feel that way. Or why did Matt make me feel this way? Or that I need to do something about
let
it.
Let me fix it.
Which is very common. You know, a lot of modern teachings are how can we fix other people rather than fixing ourselves. That's the whole idea of embracing suffering usually leads to that instead of understanding suffering. Well, you don't agree more?
I guess never been my understanding of embracing suffering. It's always to comprehend, to understand, to know. Not embrace it. You don't want to hang on to it.
A lot of times it's taught that way, to embrace it, to embrace suffering. Embrace yourself. And you're almost making a worship of suffering rather than understand that it's...
Okay.
I know you have a different experience in this, Maura, but from my observation... This is what's often taught. It's often a substitute for understanding dependent origination. Dependent origination shows that from a wrong or ignorant view, the manifestations of an ego personality is fabricated. Fabricated, the process of continued fabrication can be brought to an end. It is within an impermanent environment that a sense-based consciousness arises. Here, stress arises as consciousness continually struggles to maintain a permanent and substantial view of self. With each passing moment, in every instant, all things pass away and all things are reborn. Why hold on to anything? It requires constant vigilance and continual fabrication to maintain the establishment of an ego self. It is the stress of maintaining wrong views that distracts from recognizing the mirage-like nature of these views. Continuity obscures impermanence but does not establish permanence, substantiality, or a ground of being. And that's that other misunderstanding. That within me there is this ground of being that is somehow sustainable. That completely contradicts this process that the Buddha talked about. Through understanding dependent origination, it is seen that clinging to a view of self occurs. Keeping this self comfortable, safe, engaged, and most importantly, continually established, then becomes the sole purpose for existence. This is continual distraction. This is dukkha. The Eightfold Path provides the framework and right view or right perspective for observing and interrupting dependent origination. In order to see this process clearly, any notion of I or me being the cause of dependent origination, of being the ignorant individual that begins the process, must be abandoned. So I'm going to finish with this. That's the seeming paradox, isn't it? The ongoing ignorance of an ego self must be recognized and abandoned through the development of wisdom. It is also wrong view to conclude that it is an ego self that is gaining wisdom. There is nothing substantial or sustainable to gain wisdom. The views of an ego self are rooted in ignorance. Ignorance can never give rise to wisdom or to understanding. Wisdom arises when ignorance of the Four Noble Truths is supplanted by the profound knowledge of stress and the experience of the cessation of the five clinging aggregates. There's nothing left to suffer. There's nothing left to embrace. It's just that process of recognition that brings us all to that point of an awakened human being. So, any questions? I went on a little bit longer. And sorry for the interaction that might have been a distraction, but it's a good discussion here. Any other questions or comments about this? Maura, anything you want to add?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm getting persona non grata.
Well, so,
I'm just trying to understand. I really am, really, just this is why we're here.
It is. I'm trying to explain it. So it is on this point, on dependent origination, and to a certain extent anatta, that the paths diverge, and conditioned thinking is attached to other things being other than this. And it's often portrayed. And the only reason I'm saying this is we're all going to hear about this if we haven't already. And this is the difference. There's a difference between what the Buddha taught and a lot of what came later. And it's on this point that most of the confusion arises from dependent origination or a misunderstanding of this.
That's when the main damage is done, because they're using a word that's very similar, and even saying that this is the explanation of dependent origination, given a different name and a different explanation.
Completely different explanation by using that word interdependent.
You're off the
and the reason why is what is the word interdependent gives you? It gives you this cosmic being now. And it's a misunderstanding. It's not the world's worst crime to have done that, except.
Well,
it's confusing in the Dhamma.
In the Buddha's eyes, yes.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, I was trying to be a little bit funny there, and I failed. The reason why I'm emphasizing it is it is probably the most important point. It's what the Buddha awakened to, and the first thing he taught was the Four Noble Truths, so we can develop an understanding of dependent origination. So we can gain a true understanding of suffering, and again, I'm not referring this to what Morris said, but that notion of embracing suffering, and it's beyond Buddhism. We're taught that we should embrace our suffering. We create a worship of our own pain, when what we really should do is understand where it comes from and let go of the causes of it. And embracing doesn't get us there. Understanding it does.
Yeah.
And again, it might be just, I know Morris ready to jump out of her seat, that it's just we're playing with semantics.
I've never heard anyone say embrace suffering, but I don't.
I've heard it all the time.
And sometimes, you know, I might say the wrong word. That's what's so hard. It doesn't matter.
No, I didn't attribute embracing suffering to you. I hear it all the time. I think a lot of you have heard too. Embrace your suffering. It's a good thing to do. It's not a good thing.
Comprehend. No.
Yeah.
Be with. Understand.
Yes. That's the point.
That is the, you know, in the...
Don't become enamored with your own suffering either. That's just another way of...
But to understand the roots of it. If we can't understand the roots of it, if we can't see it...
Yeah, that's what this is.
Yes,
we understand the roots of it through the Eightfold Path.
I agree 100%. I agree.
Good. I'm glad you do.
I've never disagreed with that.
Well, I think...
I think some of the other... It's not the place and time to say. It's not that I travel in various different circles, and I have a significant problem. Not a significant problem. I can see the delusionary thinking. If you happen to even just open up our book of this beautiful center, it says that all religions are one.
Mm-hmm. One Dharma is.
And the goals are very different, and
yeah.
There's no argument there. That's a very confusing statement. However, in some of the other Buddhist
organizations or whatever, I really have not heard much talked about unitive consciousness. I haven't heard that so much, but that's not to say that it's not there. It's a confusion. Well, this is, I don't know, but that introductory book in our rooms is a little disturbing. But
you're not supposed to read it.
I know. Right?
Yeah,
I thought
I put it on a don't read it.
Don't read it.
It's a little shocking.
Continuing the discussion then, it's a common refrain, even though you haven't come across it, that from some of the major leaders of Buddhism, that Buddhism should be reconciled with all other Buddhist teachings and really with all other religions. And I don't think that, it's a nice thought. I don't think it's very helpful. The Buddha spent as much time, or nearly as much time, saying what his teaching wasn't in relation to what was going on then, as to what it was, because it's an important thing to understand. This isn't all one thing, and we're not developing an understanding of suffering doesn't require a unity consciousness. It doesn't mean we should be against anybody. The Buddha wasn't against other teachers. He wasn't against other religions that were well established. He just said, "This is what I teach." And when people says, "Yeah, but I'm from this guy," he says, "Well, that's fine, but I teach this." He didn't get too upset about it. He just said that was it. We're in a place that is an example of God in Wan Buddhism. To what I teach and what we develop, that's not something very relevant, is it? But yet we can take refuge in this beautiful place that Wan Buddhism has developed. They know what I teach, and they don't feel threatened by it at all. They know what I teach, and they invite us back every year. I gave my book to Reverend Dason. He was interested in it. I've read about Wan Buddhism. So just knowing that there's a difference doesn't mean we can't even look at it and maybe have a dialogue, but not about a dialogue about finding how we can unite. How about a dialogue about what's different? And maybe we'll find something about that notion of God that's useful to us if we have that open dialogue. But if Wan Buddhism says you can come up here and you have to listen to 3 lectures by our ministers, I'm not coming up here. I'm not. Because I don't see the value in it. I don't see why I put the time in that. But I had a long talk with Reverend Dason yesterday. It was a great talk. He's an incredible young man. I'm looking forward to talking to him again. He doesn't have to believe what I teach, and I don't have to believe what he teaches for them to be harmony in our lives. But in the meditation hall, in the teaching hall, where someone is teaching what the Buddha taught, he better teach what the Buddha taught and not say it's something else. To me, that's an example of wrong speech. I think it's one of the... In that context, it's probably one of the most hurtful things that I could do. And to me, anybody who says that they're a Buddhist teacher. But I have no control over that. You know, that's been going on since the time of the Buddha. I don't expect that I'm going to change it if he couldn't. But it's just important to remember. This whole talk is kind of bringing us all down, and I can feel it. And it shouldn't. What is most important is that an awakened human being showed a way for other human beings to awaken. And 2,600 years later, that same teaching is right here in this room today. That's the most remarkable thing. That's the true lineage of the Dhamma. And we can truly take refuge in what the Buddha said we should take refuge in. And the idea that a human being awakened, we take refuge in the Buddha. We take refuge in the understanding that he left his teaching and it's still here today, the Dhamma. And most importantly, in something that is very unique today, we can take refuge in a Sangha that's well focused on his teachings. Many of you don't know how rare that is, but it's pretty rare. I have students, not that there's thousands, but I have a couple hundred, that tell me what a difficult time they find finding a Sangha that is well focused and not into all kinds of other things. Mm-hmm. We're really fortunate that we've been able to do that. And do it in a place that has a completely contradictory teaching. It doesn't really matter, does it? You know, it doesn't matter. And it never should
it's
matter.
It's an individual thing.
Yeah.
It's an individual thing, so...
Yeah, the only thing that's important about the point is to be clear about the point. So me saying that I don't agree with Thich Nhat Hanh about interbeing, it doesn't follow to say, well, he's a bad guy or he's deluded or he should shut up or anything. He's a pleasant man. And he has a lot of people that follow him and take comfort in what he teaches. It's just not what the Buddha taught, that's all. Mm-hmm. It's just not what the Buddha taught. This is. And again, just to emphasize the point, this is where the teachings diverge. It's on this one point. It's on dependent origination. And most of it is simply just dismissal of it. Saying, hearing the words dependent and say, well, that means interdependent, and we'll create this doctrine of it. This is what the Buddha awakened to, and he taught the Four Noble Truths to develop the understanding of that. So again, the reason why I said I don't want you to leave here thinking I got to memorize every one of these and figure it out and see it. Don't. You're going to hurt yourself if you try to do that. Tonight, we're going to hear about the Four Noble Truths, all of us. Hope more comes.
No sunsets.
And that's...
We're going to do it in the main hall.
And that is what the Buddha taught, that everything in relation to the Four Noble Truths for 45 years. Occasionally, he brought up dependent origination when it fit. So, again, maybe occasionally doesn't mean 2.5 classes, but that's what I did. And a very interesting conversation. It's nearly 4 o'clock. One more time. Any questions about this or what we talked about today? It'll lighten up a little bit tonight.
I would see the circle that you're referring to, if it was literally drawn in a circle, if you could ever do that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I would, yeah. I mean...
It's like a chain.
I'd have to think a little bit.
Yeah.
I'd have to think a little bit about how to fit it.
Maybe we have some use for this. That's what I'm trying to
do. Wait, I was confused when you said I could see the circle. It was going in a circle. And I'm like, yeah, that's like a circle. I don't know.
They may, yeah. I don't think we should draw on it.
We could just hang everything off of that.
I don't want to create any intentional suffering for the ministers or us. I just thought about that. That is right above my head. But that does make the point too. I mean, to me, I know what that symbolizes, but so what? It doesn't bother me sitting here, and I don't think does it bother anybody else?
No.
Maura? I can't think of it. I mean, I think it's nice. It looks nice up there, doesn't it?
Well, one of these days you'll be teaching in a church. I mean, it could easily happen. You know,
I don't think so.
You need a space. And there it is, and you may have a minister in the church that says
that has happened once. And I was asked just before I came up here, would I give a talk on the Eightfold Path on a radio to a group? A radio show is for mental health. So it might seem like it doesn't really fit. This is the Dhamma. This is a religion. He says, do you think it'd be relevant? I said, I think it's perfectly relevant. It applies to it applies to suffering. It's not a religion. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be looked at that way. Right. Except it has those moral components.
As soon as you call it a religion, you're off the track.
Yeah.
But an ethical guideline, unfortunately, should be seen as a way to keep ourselves have a guideline rather than because they're not laws. They're not.
Well, yes and no. Religion has been used throughout time as a control for society to keep their actions civil. Instead of in the name of just common humanity, we should be good to each other. The notion, and then you add a higher being that's watching these things, so you better really be careful. Whether it's true or not, I'm not arguing that point. But that's where that idea comes from. The Buddha is not teaching morality in that way, that we should be good to live in society, although he used it, he instructed kings and leaders that you should act in a certain way because it's good for everyone. In other words, he discouraged kings and other leaders from being too greedy and taking and taxing people, even back then, too much and leaving your people oppressed. He said a good leader will share the wealth and make everybody feel and use the wealth equally. And he influenced people that way.
It works better that way.
But that was based on his own understanding. It wasn't based on a moral ideal that we should impose on society. He understood that that comes more effectively through awakening. We naturally remain harmless. We naturally remain generous as awakening people rather than as a function of this is how I should be. It's just something we do naturally. And that's a much more meaningful life, isn't it? It's going back to what got me and Maura going. Seeing things clearly, we're naturally loving. I don't have to think about, should I act in a certain way here? Should I treat this person a certain way? It's a natural expression of who I am. I don't have to first go past some prejudices that might change my view based on skin color or sex or age or something else. Somebody might be 3 pounds too heavy. Well, you know, we all have these things, or society has these things. As we awaken, none of that matters because we're not carrying it in ourselves. We don't have this distorted view of ourselves. We see other people in a reasonable way. We see things clearly. And that can happen quickly. Not always. It should. You know, it should. When the Buddha awakened, he seriously considered for 2 weeks, some people say a month, whether this teaching had any relevance at all, whether people could take to it. And over his consideration for that 2 weeks to 4 weeks, he finally realized that if there's just a few people, and the words that are often used, if there's just a few people that have just a speck of dust in their eyes, meaning that they're right there, they're ready to awaken, then it's worth teaching. Of course, that's not who he taught, though. Kandana had just that speck of dust in his eyes, but he taught everyone. He didn't care if they were covered in dust. Here's the Dhamma. Here's how you can do it. And if you take to it in a few short 24s, you're going to awaken. Or maybe a lot. But the point is that we can. The timing isn't important. It's, you know, when I talk about the legend of the Buddha's awakening, I say it's either from 1 day to 40 days in his meditation, his final meditation before awakening. But the timing isn't important. What's important is that he did it. If it took 40 years, if it took 400 years, he did it. If it takes us the rest of this weekend to awaken, or a couple more weeks, so what? We're going in the right direction. We're understanding what is most important about what the Buddha taught. And maybe we're losing some views of what we think he taught, or what we think it should be. It's very simple, it's very basic, it's very direct. It's for human beings to awaken with. So now we have about 1 minute to meditate. It is 4 o'clock. We've gone through a lot. What's the feeling here? 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, no minutes?
10.
10? 10's good for everyone? Okay, we'll have... I promise I won't talk too much tonight. Although it's Friday night, we got till midnight. And we'll have a nice 30-minute sit-out in that hall. It'll be beautiful. All right, so a 10-minute sit. Let's find our relaxed meditative posture. Oh, it's the big building right near the kitchen. And I saw a few people walk. You're welcome to go in and take a look too. It's not, you know, it's not off limits to us. Oh, and just one thing that I'm thinking about it. If someone could sweep the floor in the hall tonight when we're done, anyone? There's a big broom in here. Thank you. Maybe there's 4 brooms because the ministers will be in there at 5:30 tomorrow morning, and they'd like to have it as clean as it is when we find it. I'm sure we're not going to make a mess, but just that it's swept down. Okay, so find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And holding your back straight but not stiff, your ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies. And settle into your minds. Take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. to be mindful of your breath and your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath and your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by your own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. We'll meditate for 10 minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind.